Before we get too far in this Fly Racing Racer X podcast, thanks to Racetech, racetech.com. Get your bike dialed in for the spring and summer riding sessions. Get that suspension oil changed. Get the right spring rate for your weight and or speed. They got motor work as well. They got Racetech service centers all across America. If you call Racetech, you need some parts, you need some service, whatever it is, tell them you listen to Pulp, and you can save with the folks at Racetech, racetech.com, helping people enjoy their motorcycles since 1981. All right, here we go.
A Pulp MX Network production.
Welcome to the Fly Racing Steve Mathis Show, presented by Maxxis Tires, Renthal, and Motorsport.com on RacerXOnline.com. With your continuing gracious support of our sponsors, we're thriving at over 1,800 podcasts delivered with over 20 million downloads. Click the Amazon banner on Pulp MX to help us out. Donate via Patreon if it suits you. And as always, enrich your moto lifestyle by working with the sponsors who support us. The original Moto Podcast, featuring legends of the past, stars of today, season previews, race reviews, introspection, opinion, facts, and laughs. Here's the voice bringing it all to you, Steve Mathis.
Say that dedication to your frustration. It's a brilliant summer plan as we're giving it all.
Welcome, everybody, to the Fly Racing Racer X podcast show with Tom Webb, the Wolfman. Man, Moto Media legend, thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed this one. It's somebody I've been trying to talk to for a long time, and you'll find out why Tom didn't want to do this podcast for a while, right off the top. But hope you guys enjoy it. Thank you to Fly Racing. Pulp MX code to save at flyracing.com. Kinetic mesh is out. It's fantastic. It's lightweight. It's breathable. It fits amazing. I love the lightweight kinetic mesh stuff from Fly Racing. They launched it at Daytona. Available now in like five different colorways. Use the code Pulp MX to save at flyracing.com. Formula helmet's amazing as well. So thank you to the guys at Fly Racing for all that they do. Use that code and save when you're shopping for Fly. It's real easy, and they got a massive, massive inventory of off-road products, motocross products, women's stuff, kids stuff, all of it. Flyracing.com. Thank you to folks at Renthal, Monster Energy Kawasaki, Factory Honda, so on and so forth, Red Bull KTM, using Renthal products, bars, sprockets, chains, mountain bike parts as well. Their lock-on grip is selling amazing. No modifications needed. And they've got all their patterns and all their foam densities available in the lock-on grip. I've got it on my bike for a while now. I've not been a believer in lock-on, but Parabinos made me try it so we could talk about it on that show way back. And honestly, I figured I would take them off and put a real grip on right away. And yes, part of it is I'm lazy, but part of it also is I like it. It's soft. It doesn't feel like a tube there on the left side of your bike, you know? Renthal.com to learn more about the lock-on grips and everything else they make. Mountain bike parts are available in power sports dealers nationwide. And Maxxis tires as well. Thank you to Maxxis. Mountain bike tires are amazing. We know that. But McGrath helped them develop some motocross tires that Freddie Norn, Hunter Yoder, Cade Clayson, and others are using. Maxxis.com. Soft intermediate, intermediate to hard terrain tires. Thank you to the folks at Maxxis Tires. I know you haven't probably thought about them for a while, but if you haven't thought about them for a motocross tire, well, now is the time. Maxxis.com, great prices as well. I'll tell you more about motorsport.com later on. But please enjoy the conversation with myself and Tom, the Wolfman Webb, about Dirt Bike Magazine, Dirt Rider Magazine, Going to FMF, and more. Really interesting and funny guy. Thanks for listening. Away we go. All right, everybody. As promised here on the Fly Racing Racer X podcast, a legend in the moto media world, whether he's a dirt bike, a dirt rider, FMF for a little stint there as well, high torque guys. If you grew up reading the magazines like I did, then you read this guy a lot every month, and it's the Wolfman, Tom Webb. What's up, Tom? How are you, man?
Hey, good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate it. This has been years in the making. Years in the making, Tom. I've asked you a couple times. You never got back to me. I think one time you said you weren't ready. Mike, your brother Mike, has put some heat on you to do these. So I appreciate it. It hasn't been an easy one for me to track you down.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm more comfortable letting the words come out of my fingers than out of my mouth. So
okay. Yeah.
It's just you know, it's a comfort level thing.
Sure.
So let's see. We'll see how it goes here.
Yeah. No, I appreciate it, man. Like I said, I mean it. The things you've done in the moto media, everything you've accomplished, it's quite a lot. And like I said, people of vintage grew up reading you and everything else. So, man, I Really appreciate the time. I guess let's start with this. You step back from Dirt Bike Magazine, doing a little bit of off-roading, you know, taking it easy. Could you have kept going? Was it time for you to leave? What caused you to just, you know, kind of step back a little bit?
It's just the dynamics of the industry as far as paper products and magazines are concerned. It's been on the descale for the last 5 years, mm-hmm. and it was getting tougher and tougher to actually have fun doing work, building a magazine that I was passionate about for 40 years. And it turned into more of a nuts and bolts analytics thing that wasn't testing motorcycles, giving people information about product, you know, writing and talking about my heroes. It just changed. So it was time.
Yeah, it has changed a lot. It's unbelievable. I mean, I used to, besides the motocross magazines, Sports Illustrated, Entertainment Weekly, Rolling Stone. I'm a huge reader, and I would read all these things. And yeah, Tom, I just don't even read it. I mean, I work for Racer X, and I'll thumb through the magazine here and there, but there'll be some months that I just don't have the time to pick it up and read it. And that's, if you had asked me that 10 years ago, I would have said, no way, no way. And it's kind of the way everyone's habits have gone, huh?
Well, you know what? I mean, it's, to me, we've always been in a passion-driven industry. Mm-hmm. So if your passion is dirt bikes, you'll want to know everything about dirt bikes. And so I always felt it was my job, you know, to bring credibility, hopefully, to testing products and doing right by both the reader and our advertiser. But as things have morphed, mm-hmm. That became less and less important, and it was all about saving money. Saving money and then focusing on where we could make smaller gains, but make gains. And it's just the way it is.
Did you find yourself like getting directions from Ron or somebody at Dirt Bike and be like, hey, we need to do two strokes. We need to do KTM. Is that kind of what you mean? Like, cause that's the selling and that's what the numbers say people like. Is that kind of what you mean? Like targeted things? Okay.
No. What I mean is on the magazine side, mm-hmm. we could still do what we wanted, testing motorcycles mm-hmm. and testing product.
Yep.
It was on the digital side, okay, that we were strapped doing the magazine. Their goal was to get us to do all social media, all website,
yep.
and keep it current and keep plugging in new stuff and tracking analytics. And it was all stuff. It was too much. You couldn't do it all. So the fun factor went to it plunged into commode. And then testing, you know, we would want to test motorcycles and it was all about saving money. We don't want you spending money to go test.
Right.
And it's just like, anyway, the whole thing just was, it turned into a cluster.
How old are you now, if you don't mind me asking, if you don't want to say?
Oh, God, I'm 7 decades plus a year.
Okay. So it's, I mean, it's time, right?
It was time. I still enjoy it.
Do you?
I still, oh no, I still love writing and I still love dirt bikes and my whole crew that, you know, that mm-hmm. I run with, especially brother Mike, just a bunch of moto heads, you know, yep. and we just like to ride. So old or not, you know, we still like to do it.
Do you find, and I guess you said earlier, you still like writing. I've been doing it since I started around, I left being a mechanic around 05, 06. I started writing stuff for Racer X. And I went to Transworld for a year, but basically Racer X since 06. So, you know, almost 20 years of moto media. And I write these columns, observations from the races every week. And I write feature stories. And I'll tell you what, Tom, one thing I admire about you, I kind of was going through some stuff, going through some magazines. I don't have a lot new to say. I struggle to find new ways to talk about these supercross and motocrosses that I haven't done before. I find it hard to get me excited to do this because I'm 20 years in. And you wrote some hilarious stories, right, back in the day and some great, great stuff. And, like, you never found yourself like, oh, I already talked about that. I already wrote that funny story. I already thought of this unique angle for a column. Was it still getting fresh to you, or were you running out of ideas on how to entertain people? Because that's kind of where I'm at.
Well, and you know what? It's the brutal truth there. When it came to testing motorcycles, it became very, very hard to, to keep coming up with something mm-hmm. new and succulent that would make people want to read it. When you've tested, like, you know, 15 years of CRF 450s,
right,
you know,
right.
And it's just like, okay, when it comes to doing the column, I mean, that was my joy because that was me.
Yep.
That was me writing. That was me thinking back. That was me just grabbing a dollop of history in my brain and then working it going, yeah, that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I was passionate about doing that well and still am.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, I just sometimes I'll sit there and the Word doc will be empty and I'll be like, okay, how do I talk about Birmingham Supercross in a way that I haven't done before?
You know? Well, and you know what? That is tough, but that's somebody who cares about what they're writing and
yeah,
and it just forces you to think outside the box sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Man, some of your stuff back in the day, just absolutely gold, just laugh out loud funny. You guys were certainly, you know, yourself and the Hunky and even Clipper. Clipper was a little bit more serious, but man, good stuff back in the day. We lost Roland Hines not that long ago, High Torque's a publisher, owner, the man who's, you know, basically took it over in the late 70s and kind of guided it to massive heights. Thoughts on losing Roland and what was your relationship like at the end and all of that? I mean, the man kind of gave you your start, right?
You know, it was very interesting. First of all, it was a huge loss to me because he was my friend.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, when Roland passed away, all things changed, you know? And then, because he was the one that was holding the magazines together, this financially was a drain on the company, and he owned radio stations and other things, right. But he was keeping it going and because he was proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
Once he passed away, all things changed. How I met Roland started at High Torque, I don't know, 3 or 4 months before I did.
Mm-hmm.
And he was hired. I can't remember what his position was. And remember, this is a quote you got to remember when we're talking here. And it's from Mark Twain. And it's, the older I get, the more clearly I remember things that never happened. So I could screw this whole thing up.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
No one's going to fact check us anyways, Wolfman. It's fine.
So Roland started before me in mm-hmm. 1980. And he came in as kind of VP. Bill Golden owned it. I thought the magazine was, you know, we were off the charts. We were, you know, we were the biggest thing on the planet. You know, in hindsight, the magazine was about to go out of business. Bill Golden was running it out of business.
Mm-hmm.
Roland saved the ship. But Roland was tight. Roland, you know, watched spending. Mm-hmm. He did all these things that curtailed the norm that they were doing at the time. And that was especially Super Hunky. Super Hunky was, he was a, you know, a song. He was, we did it his way. And,
yep.
and there were so many things that he brought to the table that were so great for me as I think I was 25 years old when mm-hmm. I started working for him. And Super Hunky was unbelievably great, but he was also completely looked. Okay.
I've heard this.
Yes. So in ways for me to teach me writing, the skill of writing, which I had none, he was a genius. He was the best person I've ever worked with. You know, he made me read. The first thing that we did the first week after he hired me
mm-hmm.
is he goes, I wrote something for him. And you got to remember, back then we had typewriters.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, so my piece of paper that I turned in, which was how to wire grips, okay,
yeah,
which I still have, was a solid bit of whiteout because I retyped it so many times. And when he shook his head, he just goes, okay, he handed me a book, and it was, God almighty, I'm just drawing a blank right now. It was Hunter Thompson's.
Hunter S. Thompson, okay, yeah.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and he said, read this. Uh-huh. This is the way we write. So, and from that point on, for 2 or 3 years, it was a book a week he made me read. He goes, we read, this is how we write, we're wordsmiths, and mm-hmm. and this is your mana. This is golden to you. So anyway, that was kind of it. I mean, it was 1980 when I started, And it was berserk there, you know, because we were number one. There was no other magazines other than Motocross Action, and we could do whatever we wanted, mm-hmm. you know. And Rick fought Roland every step of the way on what he wanted to do, who was on the cover. You know, Roland says, I picked the covers. It was giant battles. And then it would be us sitting in the office, and we're drinking beers and smoking cigars. He would come in and just go, and Roland, very Christian.
Yeah.
Huge, very yep. Christian man. And he would come in and he'd say, guys, can you not smoke in here and drink? And Rick would just say, get the F out of here. You know, we're working on editorial crap. Who are you, you mooly? You know, it's just like, anyway, it was a wild time.
There's some debate, I think, if I remember right, because I did talk to Super Hunky years ago. I did a podcast with him. I caught up with him down in Mexico, right? And we lost him, too. We'll maybe ask you a little bit more about him in a bit. But there does seem to be some controversy on whether he quit or got fired, Super Hunky.
He, golly, Nets, I'm just trying to.
Yeah, he was pretty much over it, that's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember if he got the boot, but he was close to getting the boot. And then he went to a car magazine. You know, off-road truck magazine, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then Roland didn't rehire him, but he had him come in and do a column and a story a month, okay. like 6 or 7 years later.
Yep.
And Roland took, honestly, he took care of Rick. Rick was really nasty to Roland.
Yeah.
Okay. It was for Clipper and I. You know, we're just sitting there just like biting our nails because the whole thing was, God, it's just like it was a battle. Anyway.
Yeah. At the end, when we're going to go through your career, we're going to talk about the different steps on why you left and when you left and everything else. But you've been an editor. You've been, you know, an associate editor. You've kind of been the grand poobah of magazines, whether Dirt Ride or Dirt Bike. And then you've played a role subservient, whether it was Super Hunky or Ron Lawson. And, you know, one of the reasons we connected was the Carl Kramer podcast that we did. And Carl was very adamant in there, like, he didn't want to be editor. He didn't want that responsibility. He didn't want that pressure. You did that for a long time, and you were the ultimate, you know, sort of boss of a magazine. And then you played the other role where you were, I imagine, making a little less money, but a little less responsibility. What did you like? Did you like being the editor-in-chief, or did you enjoy just floating under the radar a little bit, doing a column and, you know, ultimately not being number one guy in charge over the years, because you've done it all.
Okay. Well, the way it kind of worked was at the tail end of, I'm thinking it's 1987, mm-hmm. it was getting really gnarly at High Torque. Like Roland, if I wanted to go, we wanted to go test water, we wanted to go to the desert, and I turned in gas receipts afterwards, he questioned me on everything. He goes, why do you have to keep spending money? And I'm going, Roland, we need to ride these bikes so we can do the best job, so we can tell people about them and have some credibility. And he just goes, this is just ridiculous. You spend way too much money. And it was on and on and yeah. on. And then finally, I was in a meeting with him, and I go, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to go to the Walmart parking lot and test them there? He goes, please do if it'll save me money. And I'll never forget that, because that's when I knew – yep. It's not good.
Yeah.
It's not
good. But I don't understand. This is the glory days of ads. You guys are pumping out massive magazines. How is he not making money? How is Roland?
Well, he was making money. He was making a fortune. I mean, circulation at yeah. Dirt Bike at the time was like 190,000. Okay. Dirt Rider was just coming up, but they were very small mm-hmm. compared to us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I had a very good friend of mine, Doug Jones, who knew Charlie Morey, who was the editor of Dirt mm-hmm. Rider. Okay. And Doug told Charlie, he goes, Charlie, you need to hire Tom, because he actually likes to ride motorcycles and can do something about this. And so they ended up hiring me. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it was that turning point. The Peterson deal for me was it was 10 years of total epic dirt bike heaven. It was so absolutely incredible, because this company, they gave you budget.
Yeah.
And then if you didn't make things happen, you were done. And they told you that.
Yeah.
Said, hey, if you do this, okay, you're golden. If you don't, you're out, and we're going to kill the magazine. And so because of that, we turned, in 10 years, we turned it from, I don't know, we were 88,000, I think, was the circ, and Dirt Bike was 190. And in 10 years, Dirt Rider was 190, and Dirt Bike was 88. So,
do you think Roland really didn't think you would leave?
I know he didn't think I would leave.
Yeah.
Yeah, I absolutely know. And so, for me, it was such a, Dirt Rider was, we had Dick LeGue, who I fought with hugely because I was still the long-haired lunatic that just wanted to spend money.
Right.
But we kept getting better, and we were surrounded with a staff on the ad sales side that were extensions of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were marketing people, and it was Scott Goodwin who was phenomenal, and Derek Bernard was there at the time, and we had really, really, Bob Weber came on a little bit later, just great people along with us. And then editorially, I had Carl Kramer, Mark Correa,
mm-hmm.
and then for a while I had Fran Kuhn, and then he left, and then we hired Ken Font. I had like four full-time guys, and we could just do a really great job and a budget to travel, to go to races.
Right.
So anyway,
it sounds like a little bit, Tom, like, and this goes to Zap or Carl or people I've talked to, you know, Tim Olson over the years, like Roland, a good guy, but yes, very frugal and, you know, also seemed to be on the sort of ups and downs with his staff. Like, even though he was making money and he had a massive bank account for all these things that you mentioned earlier, radio stations and everything else, like kind of a tough guy to deal with at times, I guess, up and down.
You know, absolutely was. Yep. But I will tell you this, because he was Christian,
mm-hmm.
you know, he was an early German, but he was still very Christian. And so in that, like my relationship with him in the last 10 years, when I was back at Dirt Bike, mm-hmm. the last 20, was wonderful. You know, it was, we talked about things in the back. We talked about things that he did that he hated and mm-hmm. things that I did that he hated. and for that, yeah, you know, and yep. it was very interesting. It was still the same deal. We weren't allowed to spend money.
Yep.
You know, I asked him one time, I go, Roland, my budget for this magazine. He goes, there is no budget. Your budget is to not spend money. All righty then.
It's nuts because, like you said, in the when you left the first time, like, dude, the magazines were crushing it back then with ads, right? And
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and it was going. But yeah, that's just nuts. So super hunky. Like I said, I did a podcast with him, and he is just one of those characters that, like, you would never see a super hunky now at a corporation or a magazine or an internet website. He's one of a kind, wasn't he?
You know what? I am telling you, he is probably one of the funniest men I have ever met in my mm-hmm. life. An absolute huge sense of humor. A really gifted writer and editor, okay, and teacher mm-hmm. of the English language. And it was his whole deal. He goes, we need to command the English language. That's what we do. And so he was a stickler for, you know, I mean, it was, if you were writing and I would turn something in, he goes, Tom, how many leads do you need here? You know, he'd be just crossing crap out on my thing. And I'm like, I'd worked like hours on that. And he goes, check your punctuation. Your spelling sucks. He goes, don't turn anything into me that has any spelling errors. And back then, of course, you had to look everything up.
Yeah.
So, but he was an absolute, he was a godsend, and he thought outside the box. So he thought shootouts. He was the first guy to do that. You know, and it was, whether it was motorcycles or it was products or it was chain loop shootouts or mm-hmm. two-stroke motor oil, or he did a lot of really, really great things. The issue that I had is that as time went on, he really didn't want to do testing that much. So, like, you know, I mean, to him, a lot of it is we would go to Indian Dunes. And I remember we were doing a 250 shootout, and I think it was in 1981, and we're on Shadow Glen. And the Husky that we had, okay,
mm-hmm.
it didn't run.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're doing this 8-bike shootout.
Yep.
I go, Rick, we can't really shoot it. We need to shoot a lead shot. And the bike's not running, and we couldn't get a hold of Mark Blackwell
yeah.
you know, whatever, this all this crap. And so my buddy John Miller was on the bike. We set it in the corner, and then we had all seven guys go around him And that was the lead shot, only his bike never ran. And then Rick wrote the shootout. And then we had editorial deadline, and he was gnarly on deadlines. You did not miss a deadline.
Yeah.
If you came in and your stories weren't in, you wrote them right in front of him.
Yeah.
You grab the typewriter and you just wrote. Anyway, he already had the shootout written. How can you do the shootout? We didn't have one of the bikes. Like, anyway.
Scott Wallenberg told me one time, near the end, Hunky would be in the office 2 days a week. Like, just when it came deadline time, that was it. Otherwise, Hunky was out. He was gone. He was not at the office ever. So.
No. He was a big.
Sorry.
Absolutely didn't want to go in.
Yeah. Yeah, you broke up there. What were you saying? He was what?
I said he was a big believer in not going into
the
office.
Yeah, that's what Wallenberg was saying. Yeah. He would come in and stay up for 18 hours straight and get it all done, and then you wouldn't see the hunk again.
Well, I am telling you, he did. I mean, we had a buyer's guide special. I can't remember what year this was, but we forgot about it. Okay, so it wasn't like, you know, we were getting emails, because there was no email back then. We showed up one day at work, Clipper, Rick, and I were at the office, and somebody comes in and says, "Hey, you got the buyer's guide copy." We're like, "Coming in?" It was due that day. So we sat there and wrote an entire magazine that day. And Rick, that's what Rick was great at. Yeah. He was phenomenal at that.
I think Wallenberg told me that story. Yes, I think I
heard that one. It was phenomenal.
This is the days of like cutting it out and pasting it. Like you had to build it.
It was all cut and paste. Yep. It was all cut and paste. And we drank heavily. We smoked cigars heavily. We did everything bad and got it done.
Okay, so you talk about mid-20s getting hired in 1980, and you weren't that good of a writer, and you made mistakes. So how does Tom Webb, like, how do you get a job in the moto media if you didn't go to school for it, or maybe you did. Tell us how you got into the industry.
You know, man, it's a wild story. First of all, yeah, I mean, we'd been dirt bike guys for a while. I mean, we started in 1967, my brother and I, riding in fields in the San Fernando Valley. And then we went to moto, and we were big moto, you know, but I knew that, you know, the talent level for Tom was not that great. I was stubborn, but I just was never that fast. And I had a very good friend of mine that I was working at Colby Honda, and he talked me into riding enduros, okay, off-road. And somehow that clicked. And somehow I got good at it. And somehow I won a lot of races.
Are these the timekeeping things, like that kind of enduro? Yeah. The checks and everything?
With checks and everything. Yep. And then because of that, dirt bike needed somebody. And Paul Clipper was an off-road guy. And he goes, and he didn't want Rick to hire some moto MX kid. Mm-hmm. And so they hired me because of Clipper is the one that made it happen. And then on my interview with Rick, you know, this is, you know, I'd seen him out at the races, out at Mudd's. So we talked a little bit, but he really, you know, he was a hero and I was like a nobody. And Rick asked me, he goes, "What's your education?" He goes, I got a degree, you know, in English. He goes, "Really?" Yeah. He goes, "What about shooting photos?" I go, "That's been my passion since I was a little kid." I lied about everything. I didn't care what it took. I just wanted to get in there.
Yeah.
And then the first story that I wrote, that's when he looked and he just goes, "It's how to wire grips. How safety wire grips." He looks, he goes, "You've never written an effing thing in your life." And I go, "Yeah, but you know what? I'm going to be good at this. I'm telling you." Anyway, so it was all lies and innuendo. That's how I got in.
That's how you got in. Wow. So wasn't like a predestined path for you to be in media or, you know, type out words or whatever, right? Like,
no, absolutely not. But you know, I was so fortunate. One, because Rick was a reader and liked to read. Mm-hmm. Well, I was raised reading books, so I've always read a lot. Mm-hmm. So it actually came to me kind of easily. You know, the hardest part about writing is having enough faith in yourself that what you're doing is good, as opposed to questioning every word that comes out of your fingers. And so once you learn to go, "No, I'm actually pretty good at this." Mm-hmm. And I am making sense, and I do have a path here. And it just started getting easier and easier and easier for me.
Oh, that's interesting. So when Hunky leaves, like the mid, so this is 1980, Hunky leaves in the mid-80s. Are you then editor?
Yeah, I was the editor all the way until 1987.
Okay.
He had left. We had started a magazine, Dirt Wheels magazine, and which took off, and it just was making, rolling just a shit ton of money. Mm-hmm. And then he started a magazine called 3 and 4 Wheel Action. And at the time, I was under Rick and Paul, and Rick was just driving me nuts. And all I wanted to do was get away from him. And so Roland said, "Hey, I'm starting this magazine. You guys know anybody that wants to be the editor of it?" I said, "I do." And Rick, we're in a meeting, and Rick goes, "You're not ready." And I'm going, "No, I am ready. I'm ready to do this right now." And that's, I left Dirt Bike, and I think that was 83 or 80. And then we started 3 and 4 Wheel Action, and it took off. And then I can't remember.
Oh, so it was more of a case of just like you and Rick weren't getting along for you to leave.
Well, he was just driving me nuts. He was just, he was driving me nuts. I mean, I wanted to go up and do things that I wanted to do. And we just fought the whole time.
Yeah.
In a good way. We were still friends.
Yeah.
In a good way. I knew my path was away from him for the moment. And so then I ended up becoming the editor of Dirt Wheels 2.
Mm-hmm.
Then we brought in Phil Beckman, I think, was doing, or Joe Colombaro was doing 3 and 4 Wheel Action. And then Rick left Dirt Bike, and then I did Dirt Bike and Dirt Wheels for a year. I was editor of both of them.
Jeez.
Did
you like the 3 and 4 Wheeler stuff? Like, did you like riding them? Did you?
You know what? I'm telling you, Steve, I dove into it. I'd never ridden a 3-wheeler in my life. This is before. Okay, it was right before him.
Yeah.
And I remember going, okay, well, shit, I've got to get good at this thing. So I call up my Honda buddies, and I just said, I need to talk to Waxeldorfer, who was like the top 3-wheel guy for Honda.
Yep.
He was gnarly. And he just, I go, "Hey, do you know who I am?" He goes, "Yeah." I go, "Look, I need to come down. I don't need to ride these things. I want to do something with you." He goes, "Done." Well, these things, they were tragically hard to ride.
Yeah.
They were so, if you had never done it, it was so hard. But I went with Waxeldorfer, and I went and I met him, I don't know, 3 or 4 weekends. I started riding every day, learning how to not kill myself on one. And we were doing well. And then right in the midst of this, we're a month into it, Suzuki comes out with the Quad Racer.
Yeah.
And this thing was a godsend. It was easy to ride. If you were a moto guy, you could do a million on it. You didn't have to worry about running over your legs and getting
bouncing.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Oh my God. And so, no, I mean, I love the Quad Racers and did well with them.
Was this the Suzuki? Was it in response to the 60 Minutes thing, or was the Quad Racer already in effect before sort of the 60 Minutes ruined 3-wheelers?
No, I think it was close in there.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, good job by Suzuki, right? Good product planning for sure.
Oh my God. I mean, that thing was, I'm telling you, it was so much fun to ride compared to a 3-wheeler.
Yeah.
I mean, a 3-wheeler on an off camber, it's, you just wish you had a neck brace on the whole time because you're going, bad things are going to happen.
Right. Did Super Hunky really drive around the great yellow dirt bike truck?
Like, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Was that a real thing? I mean, I grew up in Canada, so I didn't.
Yeah, it was absolutely a real thing.
Okay.
He lived in Granada Hills, and I lived in the center of the valley more.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would leave my car. We would go to Indian Dunes and test, and then I would drive with him in that truck. And later on, he had a van. No, he had a station wagon with a trailer. But every time coming back from Indian Dunes, either in the truck or in a station wagon, there's an off-ramp called Calgrove, and it's where we could hop off the freeway. And he goes, "Let's get off at Calgrove and drink our beer." So this was every time I go, "Rick, you know, I really didn't drink beer."
Yeah.
But he definitely drank beer. And it was get off and drink our beer.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I always wondered. That was a question like a 15-year-old Steve Mathis had, because he wrote about it a lot. He talked about it a lot, and I didn't know if it was like a real thing.
No. He absolutely did. He absolutely had it.
Okay, so he leaves, fires or quits, whatever the story is, and so now you're running both magazines, which has got to be pretty gnarly and got to be a lot of responsibility. And I'm sure Roland just doubled your pay, right?
There was zero pay level raises.
Okay, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
What was from, and I know this from talking to other guys around this era, but obviously, what's the relationship like with Jody over at MXA? And you guys are pretty independent of each other from what I understand, and very competitive from what I understand with each other, even though you're under the same High Torque umbrella. You guys, I mean, were you keeping that ethos going of competitiveness and not really talking to those guys, or how was it for you?
You know, it was really, really an interesting mix there. And Jody has always run his magazine the way he wanted to, okay, and done it superbly for what he had. And this guy is hugely smart. And if you sit there and talk to him, he has a memory. It's he can remember every single thing ever that he's done. Okay, so in moto, he remembers all things. Hugely smart guy, gifted, super organized. And then he and Rick never got along at all.
Imagine that, right?
At all. You know, there was two egos in there that were huge. And then and Jody always wanted to he wanted to keep it separate. I always had a great relationship. I love Jody. And interesting guy. And but you know what? He's out there every single week. You know, he's out at the track, he's into dirt bikes. It's like it doesn't get a whole lot better than that. So he's been a very big plus for High Torque, that's for sure.
But was it competitive back then?
It was. Absolutely. But mainly because MXA had more ads. Okay, and ads, you know, that's survival in the paper product business, and they would get our ad salesman would sell, you know, Pro Circuit, and they would get a 12 time to MXA. And Dirt Bike would get, like, you know, stuff in the back of the magazine, you know, wanted or something. And so the whole deal was, you know, we needed to be treated equally. And it kind of never was. And it just showed you that Jody was pretty gnarly about that. And he kept it to himself. As time went on, it got better and better and better. And I had a good relationship with him. But he definitely protected his magazine. And he considered it his 100%.
Yeah, it's crazy to me. Like, not so much you, because you're an off-road guy and you enjoyed off-roading. But, like, all of this talent on both sides, and even dirt wheels and things like that, like, never the two streams would cross. You wouldn't see, Daryl Eklund jump over to MXA. You wouldn't see Lance Morwood do some testing. Jim Hawley would never test for MXA. You know,
right?
And I always, like, that's so weird. But then, as I got older and started talking to guys like you, it was like, hey, man, we got our thing, you got your thing, and like, don't, you know, our shootouts are going to be different, our thoughts are going to be different. And in the end, that made two distinct magazines. But it was a little weird way of doing business.
Well, it completely is, and honestly, working together on many of those projects would have made things a lot easier.
For sure, right?
It's just like, there was church and state, you know, it was dirt bike and there was MXA and there was nothing in between, you know, there was a wall in between. So
do you remember any big blowouts with Jody? Like, obviously, like you said, you like him and he's your friend, but you remember any big blowouts over tests or this guy took the last box of chain lube out of the shop or anything like that?
No,
like,
you know what? I didn't. I mean, I was never that way. I mean, it was, you know, we just got along. I didn't see him a whole lot because Jody lives from the office. And then, so he would not be in a lot. He would be in right when they were getting ready to ship and they were just going through everything. And then, no. Not a whole lot of battles. I mean, there was, you know, not a lot.
As you mentioned, a lot of your stories involved, you know, going to Blackwater or going to another country to ride enduros or off-road stuff, which is a big part of dirt bike, right? And you would be front and center of that and doing these. When it came time, you know, you started in 1980, so you're editor in 87. Would you ride the moto bikes on the moto tracks, or were you letting other guys do that? Like, was your passion just, hey, I want to stay off-road? Or were you like, no, I'll test a CR250 at Paris or whatever?
No. I fully love moto.
Okay. You know, yeah.
I was like, every off-road guy is a closet moto head. You know, they want to be the moto guy. Okay. And off-road is just a different thing. I just have to be, you know, it's longer. You're out there for 4 or 5 hours. There's all these things that are really great about off-road. And, but up until, I don't know, I mean, not that long ago, I was still, like, Brother Mike and I, you know, we went to Milestone every single week. You know, we would go to LACR.
Okay.
We would just,
yeah,
I still love it. I still love to jump. I still like to do things. And I like that all the way through. I also felt that it made me a much better off-road rider, and which was my passion because I was kind of good at it. So,
sticking with the shootouts and bike tests, what was the pissiest any OEM got with you? Like, for a while, Jody had Suzuki was banned and he had to go buy a Suzuki. Or Brooks told me they had to go to France one time to test a new Suzuki because Suzuki was like, yeah, no, you know, we're over you guys. What'd you do, Wolfman? Who'd you piss off the most with some bike review?
You know what? There was God, I was thinking about that. There was a couple. Probably the biggest one was I got in a full bit of drama with DeCoster. I think it was in 89, was the first year of the upside down fork on the CR250.
Yeah.
Might have been 90.
It was it was 89, yeah.
Okay. And it was a piece of shit. It was honestly, the 1987 CR250 was great. 88, not so good. 89, it was horrendous. The fork was so bad.
Yep.
Okay, and so we're testing, and it was grim. And Rich Taylor was like my main tester at Dirt Rider at the time. Mm-hmm. And he's way faster than me.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't feel it was good. But I'm going, Rich, what are you thinking? He goes, oh my God, he goes, this thing's just garbage. And so I wrote that. Mm-hmm. We wrote a thing, and I talked. DeCoster goes, we're at Glen Helen. He goes, what do you think of the bike, Tom? And I'm going, I go, well, I love everything, but the fork is trash. You know, it's just junk. Nobody can make it work. We need it. Can you tell us how we can make it better?
Mm-hmm.
He goes, no, the fork is great. You wrote the wrong thing. You got the wrong fork. You need to change your test. And I'm like, Roger. This is Roger DeCoster. Come on.
Yeah.
It's like, honestly, this guy's my hero from ever. And I'm like, Roger, I go, honestly, you're telling me that we got a pre-production one or it's different than production and it's really good stock because if I'm going to change this, I'm going on your word and it's going to go to publication. Mm-hmm. He goes, you have my word. It comes out. We get another fork. Magazine goes out. The fork was trash.
Everyone said it. Yeah.
Of the year. And that's DeCoster. Roger made me change the test. So that was one of them. The other one was we tested a Can-Am in 1987.
Oh, yeah. I remember those.
It was a 400.
Yeah.
And God, I can't remember. I raced Can-Ams, you know, in Enduros for years and did really well with them. But this was one of the British ones, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the thing weighed like 270. It was so slow that I was with Carl Kramer. We're somewhere. We're riding it. I couldn't do a wheelie on it. And so I wrote a scathing test. It was a Rick Simon test. I had so much fun writing it, and it was so bad. And Jeff Smith was that, you know, he was the main guy at Can-Am at the time. And this happened right as I was transitioning to Dirt Rider.
Uh-huh.
I get the job over there. The second day that I'm there, Dick LeGue calls me in the office. He goes, I just got a call from Bombardier, Jeff Smith. They're pulling all the advertising because of the test you wrote at Dirt Bike.
You're like, oh, welcome to the new job, right?
Oh, my God. Anyway, we ended up getting through it. But after I was a little bit, you know, I didn't get so fun with what I was poking fun at.
I think Jody put that thing in a shootout or something. Like it was kind of a rebranded new effort from Can-Am, and it was horrific, right?
It was so bad, and they had some really good. I mean, once ATK worked with that motor, they did some really good things with the air cooled Rotax motor.
Mm-hmm.
But the Can-Am was just hideous. It was awful.
So transitioning from there into what are some of the best bikes you remember? What bikes did you test at any point? Dirt Rider, Dirt Bike, where you were like, this is amazing. This is an amazing bike. You mentioned the 87, obviously, CR250. That
87, CR250, my favorite ever. 81, Husky, 430 XC.
Okay.
One of my favorites ever. Great motorcycle. The first Oh, 83 480 Honda. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite motorcycles ever. That thing, and they ruined it shortly thereafter. They went to a 500 air cooled awful machine. KTM 300. Once they started, God, I think it was in 1990. That was a great motorcycle. And then, actually, there's been a lot, but the new KTM TPI bikes, I love. Absolutely love them.
Yeah, yeah. I hear you got to put a CDI on them to wake them up a little bit, but yeah.
Well, you do. Yeah. I mean, you can wake them, but it's actually pretty easy to do. Mm-hmm. And then the power it's just friendly, but it's massive, and it's, yeah, they're. I mean, today's motorcycles are all pretty good, but I really like the 300 TPI.
So. Yeah, it makes testing tough because obviously I'm good friends with Chris Kiefer, right? And he's up here hosting a show with me every now and then, and he rides all the bikes and he works with Triumph. He did Honda production stuff for a long time, and yeah, he's not even really doing shootouts anymore because he's like, dude, they're all so good. Like, if you find a dealer that can give you a deal, or it's close to your house, or he supports you. Like, even the RMZ is a good bike, you know? Like, it's not like in your early days of dirt bike and dirt rider, there were clear shitty bikes, you know?
Oh, no, and you were absolutely, and Chris is 100% correct, too, because they're all good. And if you do have a dealer that is, and he likes to work with you, and he has parts, and, you know, I mean, that's 100, because all of the current motocrossers are phenomenal. They honestly are. On the off-road side, they're all pretty stinking great too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like
Fly Racing Racer X podcast with Tom Webb, the Wolfman, talking about his long career. Again, thank you to Renthal, Maxxis, motorsport.com for all coming on board this podcast. Tom, it's time. Jim Hawley, a legend. You had him jumping over the chips guy. You had him jumping a Goldwing. You had him jumping a bike, I think, with no gas tank on it. I think that was him. Him and Steve Schmitz just getting absolute nutball on the cover. Give me the ones that you can print or that we can talk about, Jim Hawley stories.
Okay, well, there's I'm telling you, there's at least 100 of them I can never mention.
I know, never. Right? Yeah, I know. The authorities will be involved or something.
Oh God, no! It would be bad. Yeah, because I went to a lot of races with them. We went to Calgary. We just.
Oh, wait! Before I forget, I told Hawley I was doing this, and he told me to bring up the story where from Calgary. You told him, dude, everybody's jumping this double or triple. You can do it. Don't worry about it. And he tries it and absolute weeds himself. And it turned out no one was jumping it. You were mistaken. You were at the wrong jump or something. And Jim told me, make sure you tell Tom this story.
That's absolutely 100% true. That was such a great event because that's where I named Rollerball. You know, he had the full gnarly race.
Yeah.
Right up there. And there was one, you know, it was just one of those jumps and yeah, he didn't do it. He broke his ankle. He's not very happy with it.
No.
But the thing is what he didn't tell you was that when I went to go to my room when we first got there, my room was my room, but I wasn't in it yet and he was. And he wasn't alone.
What happened to his room? Who knows, right?
Yeah,
who knows?
Well, he was staying with his dad.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
There.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Al was in the room, right?
Al was in the room. So he was in my room, you know, doing the nasty.
He's a legend. But okay, so there's 100 stories that you can't share, but which ones can you share?
You know what? Jim is one of those guys. First of all, we were so lucky to get him because at the time, this is like in 1981, and he was like a 120, just going to 125s. He was riding for O'Neill. Mm-hmm. O'Neill was just kind of coming up, and Rick and Jim O'Neill, really good friends. And we needed a test guy. And then Jimmy came on, and we had Ken Zerk at the time, pretty stinking great guy that could do anything. You know, I mean, he was a jumping artist. Well, Jimmy was not quite as gifted as Kenny in the air, but he could do anything on any bike also. Mm-hmm. And so he was, one, a huge pleasure to work with because he was fit. He was willing to ride anything and try anything. And then when we had story ideas, like we had our April Fool's issue. And so it wasn't a Goldwing that he jumped, but it was a Harley.
Okay.
Okay, so we did. We got a full dress Harley.
Yeah.
And we went up to the hills. We're in Chatsworth somewhere, and we're on somebody's property, and he's jumping the freaking this 700-pound vehicle off these jumps for our April Fool's issue. It was hysterical.
Yeah, those issues were really great. They were.
Oh my God, they were so. And one of the other things that I will never forget is we were doing something, and I was going to go right to Ascot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm talking to Holly, and he was at my house. He would do yard work, and he got along with my wife great. They were in a good way. She knew exactly what Jimmy was.
He brought my wife a bottle of wine in the press box. I'm like, hey, babe, just stay away.
Yeah, he was good. He was good with Roost. But anyway, he's going, look at, I'm going to race at Ascot tomorrow night. He goes, I am too. He goes, can you take my bike? I go, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I go, what are you going to do? He goes, well, I'm going to ride my bicycle there.
Okay.
And he did. It was like 60 miles. And he rode his bicycle to Ascot. It's not a real nice place to even drive around unless you have locks on your doors.
Yeah, yeah.
And anyway, that was Jimmy. Jimmy was, you know, he was willing to do anything. I remember we're up at Gorman. We had an XR 500, and mm-hmm. we're trying to do some pitching shot. Fran Kuhn was working with me, and this guy was one of the greatest photographers ever. And Jimmy is doing things, and finally I'm going, Jimmy, I go, we need to show something bitching. So we found this giant fire road that kind of had a hump in it. And so he goes, well, I think I can get air off of this thing. When he gets back, I mean, the bike did like 100. He hit it at 100. And he was just, and didn't get a lot of air. But he flew for like 300 feet.
Yeah.
Just like, and I'm like, and he did it a million times. And I'm just like, oh, okay, that's enough.
Yeah.
Just die here. It's like, wow.
That Chips with the Penhall on the cover, that gap, that's like an XL he's jumping, I think. I don't know if it's him or Schmitz.
It was such a piece of crap that
yeah.
he was jumping. And no, that was funny because we wanted, that was all about getting their advertising because they were coming out with gear.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And yeah. that was the whole point for that. And then I don't know how we got a hold of the Chips guys, and they actually showed up, and it was another one of those things. You're looking going, wow, how the hell did this happen?
So photography, riding, testing. What, obviously you like the testing the best. Did you ever start to enjoy photography and get into that?
I love shooting.
Did you?
Yep. I mean, shooting is, I mean, I absolutely love it. And it's one of those things I'm actually fairly good at. I'm not, you know, quite as dedicated as like Mark Correa.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as test bike stuff, pretty stinking cameras. The cameras are so good now; it's really helped. But
yep.
I was raised in the era, you know, where you know you had to know f stops, and there was no autofocus, and it was film, and it was you got to figure out backlighting, and so I because of that, you actually learned how to be a pretty decent photographer. So and I still love it.
Yeah.
Photography.
Yeah, those are the days of film too. Like you guys would just
oh yeah, 100% film. Yeah.
Yeah, like it's when I talked to Kit Palmer about you know. The way he used to do things for Cycle News and getting him in the little teletype fax thing or whatever that was. The days are so different from now, you know, it's just nuts.
I am telling you, I remember when the first car phone came out. Okay.
Yeah.
And I was so pumped because I worked at Peterson, which is on Sunset Boulevard, and uh-huh. I lived in the Antelope Valley, which is a long ways away. And so there was nothing to do in the car the whole time. As soon as we got a car phone, I'm like, God, I can actually do work.
Yeah.
This is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And then within that year, Dick LeGue grabs me. He goes, look at this. There's this new little thing, and we can actually send emails. And I go, what the hell's an email? He goes, so we can write it on here, and you can send in your stories. I'm like, are you kidding? This was like the greatest thing yeah. ever. It was absolutely stunning. Yeah.
I always remember. You're a big guy. You're tall. You're a big guy as far as I think weight wise too. Not overweight, but just you're big. Were the bikes? Did you always have like? You sort of had to probably keep in mind, Tom. Like, hey, this bike's set up for 170-pound, you know, B rider. So that's another challenge you probably had to deal with when you're testing off road models and dirt bikes, right? And MXers.
Well, no, 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like
photos of you are like, you're huge on some of these things.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm you know, older, fatter, and bigger than I was back then.
Mm-hmm.
But still, the way we had to, like, if it was my bike personally, all the guys that I dealt with, whether it's KTM or Husky or Honda or Yamaha or Kawasaki, it was we would respring my bikes immediately. Because I would never rate them on
okay, yeah,
for a guy that's 150 pounds.
Right, there, right.
You know, there's no way I couldn't. I was just squishing the tires off the thing, and so it just became, you know. And as my knees got worse, then I had to have a seat that was a little bit taller.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I could, you know, so we I tried to keep it. You know, we're evaluate the motor. We're gonna evaluate as much as we can. And things, it's got to be for a guy that's 165 and not, you know, 225. So,
you know, I was telling Kiefer when we were talking about shootouts, one thing I loved, I don't know if it was your idea, if you were running things or if it was super hunky, but I absolutely loved the shootout that you guys did it a couple of times. You would line up the six bikes or five bikes, depending on, you know, if KTM or Kajiva's in it or whatever. And you would be like, hey, the top end of this bike. And back then, you know, late 80s or whatever, the top end of this bike's $4,000 or retail, let's say. I'm just pulling a number out of my butt. And that bike, we can't spend any money on that modification on that bike. And the Suzuki is $600 cheaper. So we get to spend $600 on the Suzuki to fix the stuff that we want. And I love that. I love that format. I always think about that. I was like, that's a great way to do a shootout, you know, because, yeah, like that matters for people.
Well, you know what? I can't remember if that was us.
I think it was you. I'm almost positive it was you guys. Yeah.
I mean, I think it was, and it was, you know, again, part of the whole point is one, you don't want to shoot the OEs in the, you know,
no,
in the ass and say your bike sucks. You know, your whole thing. I mean, I learned this from Ed Scheidler, you know, worked at Yamaha mm-hmm. for years, and they would come out with a motorcycle and he would just come out and he would say, hey, here's our new YZ125. He goes, it's a piece of shit. It's so slow. He goes, but here's how we can make it fast.
Yeah.
Because people are still going to buy it. They're still going to have a dealer that they love.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still going to get a price point that they like. And if we can say, hey, you pipe it and you carb it and it's these reads, and then you're kind of in the hunt, then we win, Yamaha wins, and the aftermarket wins, and the reader wins.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of our goal.
Right. Huh, interesting. Yeah, I like it. Hey, so you go to Peterson. Roland tells you to test bikes in a Walmart parking lot. You get the offer to go to Peterson. I imagine you're making more money. You're the editor there. And I don't know if you're responsible for this, if this was before or after your time, but I think it was right around when you went there, if I remember right. You guys at Dirt Rider started a moto section, right. You know, like an insert. Was that your idea? Was that already being done by the time you got there?
No, that was absolutely my idea. And it came because, you know, it's weird meetings that we had with like the MSR guys
mm-hmm.
who wouldn't, they, you know, they all came down and they said, hey, we're not going to advertise in your magazine. It was Wayne Cornelius, a very good friend of mine. And he just says, Tom, he goes, you know, Dirt Rider sucks, you know, moto, you know, we're off road guys, but the moto guys, the moto magazines work better for us. And so we just went back and I was saying, man, we gotta do something. We gotta be able to get the moto guy in here and then come up with an ad rate that's maybe less than what we charge for the main magazine, and we'll just have a section. Anyway, it was just me brainstorming and we did that for, I don't know, a year or 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it just got people in, and then pretty soon it just migrated into the magazine and became part of the magazine anyway. But at the time it was all about getting the aftermarket to support us, which at the time they would not do. You know, they just believed that Dirt Rider was a bunch of old guys that wore Levi's and lineman boots and you know, and rode TR6s, you know, to the desert.
So. Yeah, I loved it. I mean, I grew up moto. I'm a moto guy, done very little off-road, but we as a family, we subscribed to Dirt Rider anyways. And, you know, I remember loving that insert in there. So as you're growing Dirt Rider, how are you growing Dirt Rider to those numbers? Like, what are coming two or three things that you think really helped? And then what's the relationship like with, I'm guessing, I think Ron Larson took over after you. Maybe I got that wrong, but what's your relationship like with the high torque guys after you make this jump?
You know what? I got along with him. I mean, one of my best friends is Robbie that worked at DB forever, and Derek Bernard worked there. You know, they're all my friends.
Okay, so nothing changed that way. Yeah.
Nothing really changed that way. I mean, there was definitely my whole goal was to bury them.
Sure.
100%. I didn't care, and I was the great thing about Peterson is I was empowered. I was the boss. Okay. And so we had great people that did other things. You know, our ad guys were phenomenal marketing people to push our product. Our circulation department was stunning into giving us what we wanted and getting the magazine out where they wanted to get it and what worked on the cover and what didn't. And the whole group together gelled. We had monthly meetings and weekly meetings and just talking about how are we going to get there? What do we need to do? How can we do it better? What's it going to cost us? Who can do this? And then the big guys at Peterson, Mr. Peterson and Wayne Groh, who was the VP, they just said, okay, here's the budget. And they would tell the circulation director, it was Nigel. He would just go, okay, Nigel goes, I can do this. Let's do a bike giveaway and to sell subs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, well, how can that pay for it? You know, you can get like this $5,000 motorcycle.
Yep.
He goes, Tom, it pays for it in a second in subs. And I'm like, well, anyway, that whole company, we gelled like that, okay, for 10 years.
Yep.
It just kept growing and growing and growing and got better and bigger. And it was all about the team there. 100% the team. And they embraced who was in charge of what they needed to do and gave them the rope to kill themselves or make it better.
What kind of boss were you like with these guys? How were you?
You know what? I mean, well, that's another strange question, but it's not a strange question.
Oh.
It's a good question because I've always believed in surrounding myself with people that I can go do stuff with.
Right.
So one of my best friends, okay, was Carl Kramer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and Carl, I knew he grew up in the field across from me in the San Fernando Valley long time ago. And he had gone through Cycle News, was a dirt rider when I came. Well, Carl loved to ride. He loves to ride dirt bikes. So this is absolutely stunning. I've got a guy that loves to ride dirt bikes. So that's what we're going to do. I have Mark Correa. Mark loved to ride, but he kind of lived off. But Mark loved to go to the races. And my whole goal was, I wanted, you know, everybody, there was a lot of moto magazines. I wanted to make heroes of off-road guys.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we wouldn't, I grew up, you know, with Dirt Bike back in the day and Motorcycle Weekly and Cycle News and just dying to see a picture of DaCosta or Lackey or Mike Hartwig or somebody. And then we would have, and so I felt like I had to make heroes of them. Okay. Because this was good for me. And those guys, fortunately for me, I had hung with, like, Larry Rossler became a great friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Burleson became a great friend of mine, and we rode together a lot. And because of that, it all transferred into stories for the magazine that I had. You know, we had key guys. You know, somehow Ricky Johnson liked me. I still don't know why, because he and my brother worked together, and Ricky loves me. And I'm like, and so he loved what we did.
Yep.
And anytime we wanted to do something, Ricky said, I'm on it. Johnny O'Mara. Good friend. He was a local guy, you know?
Right.
So I kind of lucked out. I had a little bit of credibility with the moto guys. And then the off-road thing gave me more credibility with the manufacturers and their heroes. And it just kind of gelled.
Nice. I was going to ask you about the moto stuff. Now, was there ever a point for you, Tom, where you were a beat guy at the supercrosses and motocrosses? Like at any point where you would go to 3-4 races in a row and you know, do the Kit Palmer thing? Did you ever, was that ever you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, No. We went to, because you're talking back in the day, early 80s, you know, you could go anywhere on the track. You could shoot on any, you know, anything. We went to everything close when I was at Dirt Bike because there's no budget to go far away.
Right.
And then when I was at Dirt Rider, yeah, we would do, you know, we always did Speed Week and we had Daytona and then the National there. And then there was off-road races, the Alligator Enduro and the GNCC. And then we always covered quite a few. I mean,
yep.
I remember going to Detroit with Dick Miller. This is like one of my favorite stories ever. Okay, and this is probably in, and he was doing, we had, it was Motocross magazine.
I think
it was
Motocross. Yeah.
Okay, at High Torque. And so, and Dick was irritated. Dick really didn't like Roland at all. And he just goes, he comes over, he goes, hey, I got a spare ticket. You want to come with me to Detroit? And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, this is like, I'd only been doing this for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And then, so we're flying there. God, I can't remember how this happened, but we landed and they, somehow they checked Dick's luggage and he had his gun in his luggage. And anyway, we ended up going to that race and it was one of the, it was like, I think Donnie Hansen won both. It was a 2-day thing. I think Donnie won them both. And then, and God, it was just this stunning, it was just a great thing. But what the one thing that I remember we had one room, one bed. And so Dick and I are sleeping on the same bed and I've never done that. And I remember him looking at me, I was snoring, I'm sure. Yeah. And he pokes me and he goes, do that again and I'll shoot you. Anyway, pretty big fun.
I thought Dick, I got my Moto Media history wrong. I thought enter Roland, exit Dick Miller. I thought that's how it went.
No, okay. He was there for a few more years, okay. Not a lot of years.
Yeah, yeah.
If Rick and Roland fought, it wasn't even close to Dick and Roland. Dick, he was a nasty boy.
Yeah. So how was your relationship with the motocross and supercross guys? You mentioned Johnny O and RJ. Like, did you get along with all these guys? Did you ever get pissed one of them off? Because I've pissed a few of these motocross guys off over the time. How did you like dealing with motocross guys, obviously compared to the way laid back off-road dudes?
You know, I mean, some of the key guys were easy for me. Like David Bailey, good friend of mine.
Yeah.
I you know, because they were Honda tested in Simi Valley at the Honda test track. Mm-hmm. And so it was him and O'Mara, and I was close, and we would see Johnny all the time at Indian Dunes, mm-hmm. and he goes, come on out here. And so we would just hang with them. So, and then that helps build the relationship. It was just, it was relaxed. It was these guys training. We could shoot photos and talk to them. So I got along great with him, you know.
Yeah.
And Donnie Hansen was local. It was mainly local guys. Brock, you know, Brock became a kind of a friend of mine later just because I like to play golf.
Right.
And Brock's a huge golfer. Mm-hmm. So, but I got along with them great because, you know, then again, those guys were my heroes, every one of them, you know? So, we had a few weird things like Jeff Ward, we had to meet with him. We wanted to shoot a KX 125 at Saddleback.
Okay.
And wanted Wardy. And we go there and Jeff is just putting in motos. It's the middle of the week. It's baked dry death.
Yep.
The track is, it doesn't even look like you can walk around it. It's so slippery. And so he's just going. Finally, I go out there on the track and I wave him off. I go, hey, we need to shoot some photos. He goes, dude, he goes, when I'm done training, he goes, we'll go shoot photos for 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right, Jeff, I guess that's the way it's going to work.
I remember that issue. Was that 84?
Yes, it was.
I remember. So he just shot. Yeah. I remember you guys slapped number four on the bike and he did some whips.
Yep.
And that was 5 minutes.
Yep. Yeah. And then he's turned into it, you know, after that. But at the time, mm-hmm. he was all about racing.
Yep.
You know, it was like, hey, we get more consumed with it. And I get that.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. So you're at Dirt Rider. And then you go to FMF Honda. I was at FMF Honda. I want to talk to you about that. But you go to FMF, Donnie Emler, obviously you probably know him over the years. Why the move? What happened? Take us through that.
You know, the at Peterson, things were, we had started a mountain bike magazine, mm-hmm. and we started a road bicycle magazine. And then somehow, because my magazine was doing great, they decided I needed to be the editorial director of all these magazines.
Okay.
It was a great thing, except for the fact that the mountain bike editor, he was really hard for me to get along with because they didn't like me because I wasn't like a mountain bike guy, and then the road bike guy, they're more anal than anybody I've ever met in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't want to, you know, if it's not an Italian bicycle, if it's something new, they're like, they don't even want to touch it. So I had, it was trouble trying to make good things happen there. I mean, one really great thing happened is that I hired Joel Smith, Malcolm Smith's son, and to run, who was a big mountain bike guy. And I'm like, okay, I love Joel. Mm-hmm. And we were buddies. And so we turned that magazine and we made great things happened because Joel and I were buddies, and then we could ride together and have fun. But the Road Bicycle magazine, God, it was brutal. I could never find somebody to work with. And then Peterson sold. I can't remember who bought them, but they were selling the company. Mm-hmm. My job turned from being an editor, you know, a guy who rides dirt bikes and rides mountain bikes and shoots photos and writes stories, to sitting in front of bankers selling, you know, what our magazines are and who they represent. And after a while, I'm like, this is just bullshit. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't fun for me. And at the same time, I think it was Honda's 50th anniversary. It was some anniversary that they had in New York. Mm-hmm. And I was invited to go. Okay. And so I'd never been to New York. I'm thinking, oh shit, I'm just going to go there. And it was at a cool hotel, and Dick Clark was going to, we're going to have the Rockettes, and bits and stuff going on. Well, I'm in the hotel and I'm riding the spinner. I'm at the gym in this hotel and Danny Laporte's there. Mm-hmm. And Danny's like, somehow, I don't know why he likes me, but he's one of my great friends. And he sees me and he's, you know, he and Donnie are related.
Yep. Yep.
And
Donnie's married to Danny's wife's sister. Is that it?
Mom.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
So, right.
And yeah. So Danny is like the most down to earth, got the most malicious person.
Yeah. Great guy. Like,
And so he's asking, and I said, what's going on? He goes, well, we're getting the Honda team. The 125 team. I go, you're kidding me. I go, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to market that? You know, what's your game plan? I'm just asking him all these questions. And he goes back and tells Donnie, he goes, we need to hire Tom because he will do good at this. And it was just happened to be at a time where I had had it with the new Peterson because I didn't like the way things were going. And so I ended up leaving and went to work for Donnie.
So if Peterson doesn't sell, you don't leave. Like,
no, I would have never left.
Yeah.
I would have never left. not a chance.
Yeah.
It just got, you know, it's unfortunate. I've always had like the ice cream taster job. It's like, it's always been fun. And when it starts getting not fun, I go, I don't want to do this if it's not fun. So Donnie talks to me, and he'd been a friend of mine for and a big supporter of any magazine I worked for. And I tried to support him and help him. So I loved the whole idea. And so I made that transition there, which was a giant upheaval in my life because I had to pull up my family and I had two little kids and we had to move to the South Bay.
You had to be there every day, I guess, in the office.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Now, see, this is what I learned about Donnie, one of my great friends. But after it's like 2 or 3 years, I realized that, you know what? He just follows you behind. I mean, it's mm-hmm. he could see in his mind who was costing him money. So if you were talking to somebody, he's going, okay, I'm seeing that's like $300, $400. That's probably $600 talk right there.
Jeez. Wow. You know, he doesn't put off that because obviously like he's such a child of the 70s and he's sort of like wing it. And I've been involved with him a little bit and he doesn't come across as a guy like a micromanager guy a little bit, but it is his company, right? Yeah.
It is his company. And you know what? I mean, and I had come, Donnie didn't do anything wrong with me. We're still really great friends, mm-hmm. but I had come from a company with a plan, with a budget, with here's where we're going to go. And Donnie was a wing it and
see what happens.
and controlling in a way. And so it started getting tense. I mean, we had a great run because when I got there, I just realized, I mean, you know, we mainly sold through distributors, through parts and through Tucker.
Right.
And then I'm like, man, we need a sales guy in here, a really great sales guy. And Bill Baroth is one of my best friends.
Yep.
He was just leaving at Cherubies. And I said, we need to hire Bill because he can go work. We hired Bill. I talked Donnie into it. Bill just, I mean, FMF, it shot straight up. We just started making more and more money, and Bill did a great job. And the Honda team was a giant drain. Honda, I mean, Donnie hated doing it. Anything that cost him money, he's like, oh, my God. He goes, why doesn't Honda pay for that? I'm like, well, they want us to do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it just started
I always, sorry to interrupt you. I thought your job there was a media guy, a media liaison for FMF, but it sounds like you were really...
No, I was the marketing director.
Yeah, yeah, sounds like you were all aspects, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I did the catalogs and did shoots, and the internet was just coming in, and I was working with a friend of mine, Brad Zimmerman, who's passed since, but he'd worked for Modern Cycle and Motorcyclist back in the day. Mm-hmm. Great internet guy at the time.
Yep.
We got FMF site going. Just did a lot of really good things, but at the same time, my dad got sick, really sick. Mm-hmm. And I had to help my mom, and they lived in the valley. It was just, I had to leave a lot, and Donnie didn't like it, and it just started getting weird and
interesting.
Yeah, and it was just like, I go, let's just go and be friends. I knew Dirt Bike would hire me because Rob Mesker was there, and I just talked to him, and he just goes, no, we'll hire you in a second.
But it wasn't Rob the ad guy.
Yeah, he was the head guy. I had gotten his job there in 1987. He was like a kid that I knew that was a local enduro guy, and I got him a job as an ad sales guy.
But the ad guy can make a promise for a job? Cool.
Well, he went and talked to Roland.
Okay.
And he goes, look at Roland, we need Tom.
Yep.
You know, and he can work with Ron. You know, Tom will do it. I already told him, I go, look at, I'll just bend backwards. I can have a thick skin.
Yeah.
You know, let's just go. And just because I needed to get out and I needed to take care of my kids and family for a while. So anyway, that's how that happened. You know, just still great with Donnie. Yeah. Still a great friend of mine. So.
That's where our paths crossed a little bit. And I highly doubt you remember, but I halfway through Supercross in 98, I was working for a privateer named Ty Birdwell. It was my second year on the circuit as a mechanic, third year. And FMF Honda fired a couple mechanics. They got in a fist fight. They just hated each other. So a couple guys got fired. I got picked for the job to work for Danny Smith. Now, I fucked up the bike a couple times, Tom, so I wasn't really ready to be a great mechanic back then. But I got there, and I was like thinking I was stepping into factory Honda, you know, 125 team, and this is going to be amazing. And yes, very disorganized, very, very – Bobby Moore was the manager, but he lived in Arizona, so he wasn't around. And Varner – had his own ideas how to make a CR125 run, and then Mike Hooker had ideas that he didn't think Varner knew what he was doing, and Varner didn't think Honda knew what he was doing. We were caught in the middle. Results weren't good. The bike wasn't good because of the aluminum frame, 125s, airbox, all that. And I got the job, Tom, and I spoke to you a couple times like at the race shop down in Torrance, and I got the job, and I was like, holy shit, this is so disorganized.
It was a cluster of titanic proportions.
Yes, yes.
It was, you're 100%. Bobby, you know, Bobby,
nice guy.
Getting outside sponsors but there was no real management. There was no plan. There was no organization. Danny and I would go in. God, we got called into meetings at Honda, and I'm with Cliff White and all these, you know, big wigs at Honda. Yeah. They're just yelling at us. What are you doing? I'm like, I'm not empowered to make decisions here. I'm just not. You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was brutal.
It was not good. Yeah. And I remember one day, actually, this really stands out. You came into the shop and you're like, hey guys, I don't remember. Like, hey, you got to build these bikes for sale or something. You know what I mean? Like, you told us to do something, right? And we're like, okay. And a couple of us got together and we, you know, built motors or I don't remember, built something that you told us to do specifically. And then like a day later, I think Terry comes in and goes, what are you guys doing? And we're like, we're building these motors because Tom said so. No, you, the totally wrong thing. Take those motors apart or take the frames apart, whatever it was. And I just remember going, oh my God. And so long ago, I don't know whose fault it was, but that was an idea where we were like, what is going on here?
see, we didn't know. And Varner had his ideas, and he fought with Cliff on it. And the whole, it just turned into, our motor department turned into just doing cylinders for those 125s. And then it wasn't making money anymore.
Yeah.
And then Rob Henderson was doing the suspension. And then it turned into, now we weren't making money doing suspension. We were just doing Honda suspension because there was so much doing it and shipping it. And Donnie just
the money. Yeah, Donnie was blowing a gasket at the money.
He just blew a gut. He's just like, this is ridiculous. And I'm like, you know, I'm sorry, but
I remember too, Mike Hooker's like, hey, here's the jetting for your bike. You know, here's what Lampson ran and here's what we want you to run. And then Varner would come in and be like, what main's in here? Because he would take your bike off the stand. And what main is in here? You'd be like, 172. Put a 178 in. You're like, okay, cool, Terry. All right. So you put a 178 in. And then that Saturday at the race on practice, you know, Cliff or Hooker would walk by and be like, look at your bike or listen to it or whatever, and be like, what main is in there? You're like, well, Varner told me 178. He's an idiot. Put a 172 in. And we're like, dude, what is going on here?
Oh, you know what? Yeah. You know what? You were, that was, yeah. It was chaos. It, 100%.
It really was. It's interesting though that, you know, and you've done so much in the industry that you kind of knew like, hey, I want to stay friends with Donnie Sr. It's time to go.
you gotta break bread and just go, okay, look, we're gonna live on this side of the street, so
right and then so back to dirt bike. And did you have a sort of a come to Jesus meeting with Roland, or was it like you said, Rob had cleared it up that you were good, but did you have to sit down and either, you know, like you said, you know, take a little bit of humility with Roland, or was it open arms and you're back?
No, absolutely. But actually he was really good.
Okay.
And he just wanted me, he goes, Ron's the editor. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to just jump in here and do whatever I can to make the magazine better. And so Roland, you know, he just talked to me, he goes, I believe in you. You know, we've been friends, yada, yada. He was actually hugely positive. He goes, you need to make it work with Ron. So I'm like, okay, there was still no clear plan for dirt bike at the time. Mm-hmm. There was still no budget. There was no travel. There was no anything with that magazine, and it was actually chaos. You know, it was chaos for a while, and it got actually a few years into it, it got a little bit ugly.
Okay.
Because the ad guys wanted me. They're just going, we want Tom back in because I work better with the advertising. You know, with our clients.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ron lived pretty far away, so I was in the office more. The whole thing just kind of got muddied and weird again, and it worked well for a while. I had Adam Booth was working for us, and he was a great photographer.
Mm-hmm.
and loved to ride, but he was not the friendliest person.
Okay,
and I got along with him just fine. Because he produced,
yeah,
and I had somebody to ride with. And
a lot of your stories boil down to I have somebody to ride with.
I had somebody to ride with. Okay, but Ron did not get along with Adam, and nor did anybody else in the company. And so it was a little. Adam ended up leaving, and then Ron promoted. He wanted to promote Mark Tilley to Adam's position. Mark was one of our test guys forever and then worked as a road salesman. And so they both live, you know, they live in Corona. Mm-hmm. And so then there's Tom. Tom's at the office. Now I don't have a riding buddy anymore. So I have nobody to ride with. So anyway.
I'm guessing too, like when you went back there, it's a little cut and pay from what you remember, right? From what you... making for Peterson days and all that, right?
It was a huge cut and pay from FMF. I was paid well there.
Yeah.
And then between you and me, what they hired me in at, and so that was around 2000 or 2001,
mm-hmm.
I never got a raise after that.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. And I left in 2024.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We had one 10% deduction in pay,
mm-hmm.
but never got a raise in all those years.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. Just kind of made.
It's the magazine world, right? It's the dirt bike magazine world, the dirt bike media world, really. I can relate in some sense for sure. I'm a freelance, I'm not an actual employee of Racer X. I'm just a freelance guy. So my deal's a little different, but, okay. So a few questions. To wrap this thing up, Tom, how many 6 days have you been to over your time?
Four.
Okay. That leads me to my next question. What's been the coolest off-road riding trip you've ever been? I mean, I'm sure some manufacturers paid for you to do some cool shit. I'm sure some promoters over the years paid you for some cool shit. What's been the funnest, most exotic, coolest thing you've done?
Wow. You know, I mean, that's like...
I know, right?
the thing is you got to remember in early days is the market was so strong. The aftermarket was so strong that mm-hmm. it's got, like Malcolm Smith Racing. Malcolm Smith would have, they would have industry rides to tout their new gear. Mm-hmm. So all the editors got flown to Prescott and Colorado, and we get to ride with Mike Bell and LR and it was phenomenal. I mean, I went with Suzuki when Charles Falcon was working at Suzuki. We went in, it was for the January 1990 issue of Dirt Rider, because I'm looking at it right above my desk. We flew to Hamamatsu to test that motorcycle.
Oh, that's cool, yeah.
Oh, no, it was great. And we had to, they had to fly you business class or first class. So we were on a 747, and on our flight, Bob Hope was sitting like right up above me in first class.
Nice.
And so we flew to Hamamatsu. Yeah, flew to Tokyo, went to Hamamatsu. It was one of the greatest trips where I probably rode for 20 minutes. Okay. For photos. But it was the rest of it. It was the dinners with the engineers, and it's the just the wild crap that we did on that, you know. Yeah. It was a wild time. That was huge. Every 6 days trip was phenomenal. Going to Czechoslovakia mm-hmm. with, like, Mark Currie and I flew, you know, we drove from Austria into Czechoslovakia. And this is when it was still an Iron Curtain country. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it went from, like, you know, Hansel and Gretel, beautiful green countryside mm-hmm. into this dark kind of a country where you're like, oh my God, this is so depressing.
Yeah.
And we get to this little town where they're having the 6 days, and it was the greatest people that I've ever been around. They just took care of us. We just, you needed your clothes done at the hotel. It cost me, I think, like, I don't know what the currency was. It was like zlotys or something. It cost like 70 zlotys for a 2 weeks worth of work. It turned out that it was like 48 cents.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm looking at what are you talking about? You know, it was absolutely just great. And then Australia was probably my greatest trip. My wife and I went, and then my brother had just started working for Suzuki. Mm-hmm. And so I went down there. It was Rodney Smith's first 6 days, and he ended up like second or third overall, I think. I almost won the thing. Mm-hmm. And it was a brutally tough 6 days. But prior to it, it was 2 weeks of the week before.
Yeah,
I played golf with Randy Hawkins and my wife, and went to wineries every day until the race started. So,
did you ever do any 6 days? Did you like have teams and do them at all?
Oh yeah, no. I my first one was in Sweden in 1990.
Okay,
my bike, I made it until the final check on day five, and then it had rained, and I was on a DR 350, and I hit a rock, and the rear sprocket bent and broke the chain, and I houred out, didn't finish.
Oh, okay.
The next year I went to Czechoslovakia. I was on a KTM 300.
Oh, so you always rode these 6 days then? You always rode them?
Yeah, well, that was my goal when I was younger.
Yep.
But I wanted to be a 6 days guy. And this was the single driving force into trying to get fit, because mm-hmm. because in 1989 I was doing them, but I realized that I was in Oklahoma at a 4 day qualifier, and I was just sitting on a mountain. I was so exhausted that I really could. And I went, you know what? If you don't get stinking fit, why would you even do this? And so I did. I kind of turned into a Nazi and just trained and trained. And then, so anyway, I ended up finishing the 6 days in mm-hmm. Czechoslovakia, which was brutal. I finished the one in Australia, which was absolutely brutal. And then by that time, it was like I was 40. So yeah. I was like on the old end of this.
Yeah.
And then I rode the one in the States in 94, and that was a cluster that didn't end well.
Oh, okay. It's cool. That's interesting. So, I figured you would, like, because anybody can enter them. Obviously, you're not on the trophy team, but, like, you're still.
Well, I mean, you needed to qualify.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't just show up.
Okay.
So you had to, like, I won the 40 AMA National ISDE trophy, for the United States in 1994. And then I got two silver medals. And
nice.
And earlier on, 1978, when I started riding enduros in 77, I won a national enduro in 78, which was gnarly.
On your Can-Am, or what were you riding?
No, okay. I was actually on a YZ400.
Okay.
That I put an IT tank on, uh-huh. and then my buddy Pete Smith, who got me into off road, and some other friends of ours, we drove to New Mexico, which is where the race was, in Cloudcroft, New Mexico, and it was like 20 hours of driving and drinking, and we showed up at like 3 a.m. and fell out of the car, and the race started at 6, and then somehow I just rode great, and I just lucked out, and back then, you know, they didn't have results right away.
Yeah.
You know, so we drove all the way home, and it wasn't until Cycle News came out Wednesday that I look and I see this big thing that says Webb wins National Enduro.
Oh, like, shit! Yeah, yeah.
What, Webb won? And I'm like, oh my god, it was me. Anyway.
Yeah. Your brother Mike, obviously, like you mentioned, he ran Suzuki Off Road Department forever. Any Matt LeBlanc, Mike Webb hangout stories?
You know, probably none that I can really talk about.
Okay, all right, fair. We're moving on.
Actually, those two are really, really, they're tight.
Yep.
They've done snowboard trips and done things, and Matt is one of the best people ever, because you would never know the guy had a cent of money.
Yeah.
You know, just talking to him.
I met him at Summercross. Remember that Summercross race? I was working for Tim Ferry back then, and I met him then because he was around because of McGrath. And yeah, super nice guy.
Really cool. good guy.
Yeah.
And I've been very fortunate. You know, Brother Mike and I are like best friends. Mm-hmm. It's just like the strangest thing, because we've ridden together for now like 50 years, you know, or more than that. And our whole lives kind of intersect with... And it's all about dirt bikes.
Yeah.
So,
I really, really like talking to your brother, Mike. I've done a few podcasts with him over the years, had him on my shows. And nothing makes me laugh more than when he was talking about when he was, you know, the manager of the Supercross team and how he had to deal with James. And he was so many times, he was like, I want to go back off-road, man. I just want to go back off-road.
You know what? One of my greatest stories on that is he calls me and he goes, hey, Tom. He goes, yeah, DeCoster's leaving.
Yeah.
They want to make me the motocross team manager. And both of his boys were really young at this point. Mm-hmm. And his off-road, as an off-road manager, his life was perfect.
Yes.
He could go riding 3 days a week.
Yep.
He would go to the race on the weekend, 12 races a year,
yep.
You know, or 14. He had nothing. Mm-hmm. All he did was all gravy for him.
Yep.
And I told him, I said, are you effing nuts? Your life is going to be over.
Yep.
It's going to be over. It's just going to be travel, and nightmares. And he goes, no, I think I'm going to do it. And it was the same deal. He's like 2 months in, and he's telling me dungy stories that are just out of control. And I mean, the James years were, as bad as they were in some ways, were great because they at least had fun.
Yeah, yeah. You
know? With Dungy, I don't think there was any fun in there.
Dungy didn't want to be there. And then, you know, he runs out of gas. Not Mike's doing, of course, but the chain comes off, runs out of gas. Your brother's just like the caught in the crosshairs of...
No, it was all Mike Webb's fault.
Yeah, yeah. Wygan and I always laugh because Mike's always like, off-road was so much better, man.
Yeah. No, and he did a great job with off-road.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's certain things that he did that are to this day are so gnarly, because when he took it over, Suzuki had won, I don't know how many straight national enduros with national enduro series with Randy Hawkins. And then Mike just, he didn't like the dynamics of the fact that there were no people there other than people racing,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is like 200 or 300. And then he went to a GNCC. He just saw how big it was. Mm-hmm. And he just goes, and I was talking to him. He's going, man, I think I want to do this. But, man, what am I going to do about Randy? You know, I want to hire Rodney Smith. And he had all these kind of things before they were happening. And one of our best friends at the time, and still was Mark Johnson, who was the head of Team Green at mm-hmm. the time. And Mark was the gnarliest guy I've ever met. He was just basically would not take shit from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
It was his decision, move on, you know. And so Mike's going, I don't know what to do. And I go, Mike, what would Mark Johnson do? He goes, I tell Randy, we're going racing GNCCs and there's no more National Enduros. I go, there you have it. And that's exactly what he did.
I think, did they start on those DRZs though? Like Kudrowski and Rodney, they started on those DRZs.
They were on RMXs.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then Rodney just took to it. Rodney was, he was golden. And it wasn't until Kudrowski got hired a few years later. And then they had the work series out here in California, and they built the DRZs through Yoshimura, for MK. And
Mike has got some great Rhino stories too.
Some what?
Great Rhino stories when he hired Rhino.
Oh my God! There's some unbelievable Rhino stories.
I know, it's just like oh man. Hey, you mentioned Holly. Obviously, you mentioned Rich Taylor as well. Who are some of the best test riders? And I mean, from knowing what the bike's doing to knowing how to, you know, look cool in a corner or off a jump, or, you know, somebody who wanted to work 8 hours a day and didn't care. Like, who are a couple, two or three of the best test riders in your time that you've come across?
Well, you know, I mean, we talk about Holly. Holly is definitely way up there.
Yep.
Rich Taylor, way up there. I mean, Rich was a kid from Idaho Carl introduced me to him. And we were at the Peterson Ranch, and he just goes, you know, we're looking for test guys. We had Willie Simons was one of our test guys, and he was a great photo model. But then this kid just shows up, and Carl puts him on this Husky 250. It was like a piece of shit. You know, nobody wanted to ride it. And he just starts doing these mad dog leaps, you know, upside down air. I'm just like, who the F is this? And it was Rich Taylor, and he was like 17 or 18 years old. And he was absolutely phenomenal as a photo model. He turned into a good tester because he did a lot of work for Suzuki and for Honda. He got very good. We had Ryan Koch when I was at Dirt Bike here on the off-road side. Unbelievably good test rider, but off-road. He was basically a trials guy with pro background. Absolutely wonderful. You know, I'm trying to think of who else here right now. I'm completely drawing a blank. Oh, Steve Schmitz.
Yeah.
Like, he was like, as a not a great input guy, but an unbelievably fun guy to make anything good happen.
Yeah.
And he was phenomenal in the air. You know, he would just do air things that was stunning. And it was a tragic loss when we lost him.
Yeah, Holly said off the bike he was pretty loose. He had a wild life.
He had some demons, and then and they caught up with him, so which is very unfortunate. So
Tom Webb here on the Fly Racing Racer X podcast. Again, thank you to motorsport.com. go through the banner on Pulp MX to help us out. OEM and aftermarket parts, great prices, free shipping on everything over $79. motorsport.com. thank you to those guys. Make your next ride your best ride. Tom, man, I really appreciate the time. One thing that I get from this podcast, and it's been so many years that I wanted to talk to you, I'm super stoked that we did this. You mentioned fun like a dozen times about that was fun, this was fun, I get to ride and have fun. Dude, 40 years, Tom, it's almost probably at times, I'm sure at times, you know, it was work, but goddamn, it doesn't sound like you had to work many days in your life, right? Because it what a life you've led.
Well, you know what, and I got to tell you, and that started with, I happened to be here when this whole catalyst of dirt bikes kicked off, and everything, for some reason, from on any Sunday on, that movie motivated me to say, that's kind of what I want to do for a living. I just don't know how I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And then riding has always been important to me. And then if I can't do it riding, then what's the point of doing it if it's not fun? And that was something I learned from my dad too. And this is like my last thing I'll say is we would wake up and we'd have coffee, and I'm like 16 years old. He goes, get a job that doesn't make you want to shit your pants, because it's fun. And I'm like, holy mackerel, man. I don't want to be like that. I've actually tried to, you know, I didn't get rich doing it, but I certainly had fun doing it.
Yeah, like, I grew up in Canada, you know, snowbound for 5 months of the year, and reading your words and Jody's and all these other people and being like, these guys must have the best job. This is the best job ever. Like, these guys have the best job ever. That's all, as a kid and teenager, I would think about. Like, this is amazing. Like, did I want to be Rick Johnson? Sure. But I think realize at some point, like, I'm not going to be Rick Johnson. And and then I'm like, I just want to be these guys, you know?
Well, you know, as a writer, you still have to produce, you know, so you still have to go, okay, man, I got to make something come out of my fingers and hit these keys and make something good happen. But I actually enjoy that part too. I love writing when the writing suits me,
right.
You know, when I have fun with it.
Some of those, not everything you wrote was true, right? Like some of those stories.
Almost all of them, if they were from my columns, almost all of them were true.
Really? Because, dude, you got some funny stuff with running out of gas and being stranded and this, and your buddy did this and your other buddy did that. And
almost all of them. I mean, there could have been, of course, there's going to be some, you know, I'm going to gloss them up a little bit.
Yeah.
But most of those, the reason that those worked is because I ride.
Yeah.
I rode a lot.
Yeah.
And I rode with buddies. And I rode with buddies that were idiots and did stupid. And it's like Rick Simon always told me this, you know, I was like a good racer when I met Rick.
Uh-huh.
And Rick told me, he goes, Tom, never take yourself seriously.
Right.
Because nobody wants a serious guy. They want somebody they can laugh with. And that was hugely important to me.
Yeah.
And
what point in your professional career were you happiest? The first time a dirt bike, the second time FMF, dirt, it's not FMF, I'm guessing, dirt rider, like what?
Well, I mean, of course, when I first got hired, I was hugely happy just because, you know, I couldn't believe I got to go to races. I got to fly to Tulsa and test a Husky that I rode with Dick Burleson. This guy was my hero.
Yeah.
I mean, unbelievable hero. And I'm like, and we became huge friends after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the amount of people that I met along the way that were good, but the best times were definitely at Peterson at Dirt Rider.
Yeah.
We had the team, we had everybody around. I mean, you know, we would have ride days for the entire staff, you know, and it was like it was fake. It was so good.
You were like, you're paying me for this?
No, that's it. Exactly. You're just like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
No, I had a budget and it was just like, holy mackerel. It was good.
Yeah. Well, man, what a career. And you're still riding. That's awesome. Still enjoying it, I see. And like I said, what a career. What a fun career. 40-plus years in the motorcycle media world, testing, traveling, going to races. Pretty cool, man, I got to say.
Pretty cool.
Yep.
Pretty cool.
Pretty cool. Thanks for the time, Tom. I really appreciate it. Glad you're well. And, you know, I'm glad we finally got this done, man. I'm stoked. So thanks, man.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for making me do it.
Thanks, Tom. See ya.
Okay, bye.
This has been the Fly Racing Steve Mathis Show, presented by Maxxis Tires, Renthal, Motorsport.com, and Kuba Links on RacerXOnline.com. Thanks for listening and supporting our partners.